Blog Talk Radio.
Time now for Lydia's Literary Lowdown on Greater Good Ministries Radio. Join Lydia at 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern every Saturday and get the lowdown on today's popular authors, publishers, and pundits. Lydia's Literary Lowdown, right here on GGM Radio, every Saturday, 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern.
Welcome to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. I am so happy today to bring back the incomparable David Beeson. If you have not checked out his blog, you need to get there. I actually just sent my husband to see David's Random Views blog because he had a particularly cutting edge and commentary on the situation going on in Iraq and with the United States right now. But there's so much more to be found on his blog. And how fortunate are we that David has a compilation of his blog called Random Views, which I just absolutely loved. How are you doing tonight as it is in the UK, David?
I'm very well, many thanks. I'm in the beautiful part of the world, Dorset, made famous by Thomas Hardy, amongst others. Sitting in a cottage on, unbelievably, the River Piddle, it's called. That's the River Piddle, which I find an evocative name.
And I assume while you're sitting in that cottage, looking at the lovely, lovely scenery around you, that you're thinking of more blog posts to entertain me specifically with.
Of course. It's, everything is aimed at you, Lydia. So I feel if it can hit your high standards, it should amuse everybody.
There we are. And all you've given me are high standards because in 2 to 3 weeks, your new book, Good Company, is going to come out. Give us a little bit of that story so our listeners can know what it's all about, and I'll gush appropriately after.
Thank you. Yes, it's about a young man who decides to leave teaching to pursue a career in business. And he principally does that because he's fallen for an older woman, that is to say a woman who's in her mid-30s or he's in his mid-20s, and he finds her fascinating and he finds the doors that open up, that she's opening up for him, fascinating too. So he goes through one of those doors into a position in marketing in a small company in London from the provinces in England, and then essentially over the next 19 chapters of the book, things start to fall apart. So he discovers that the company isn't always quite as successful as it would like, and as it meets various failures, a great many tensions emerge to the surface, and without sort of wanting to give up any spoilers, some of those tensions become, quite literally, lethal. He finds that also there's a great deal of betrayal, including betrayal that he commits and betrayal from which he suffers, and all that mixes into what I feel is partly a business story, partly a thriller, with, I hope, a fairly interesting twist in the tale at the end.
It's absolutely fascinating stuff. I mean, it's fascinating. I would have been content just with the business world because I went into it with the same kind of ignorance that he has as he's making the bridge, kind of walking over the bridge from teaching into business. And you at one time taught, did you not?
I did indeed, yes, only very briefly. But yes, that's right. I came out of that world and I enjoyed the idea of the rough and tumble of business, and I still do. I'm still in business now, and it is enjoyable. But there are moments when the knives come out, and the people who use those knives use them fairly ruthlessly, and if you're a victim, it can cause you very considerable pain. I've lost 3 jobs myself in the course of a long career. I know what it is to be made redundant, and it's not a funny moment. And I thought that, you know, quite a lot of people have suffered that experience, and perhaps there isn't enough said about that kind of life. Most books about business tend to be based in boardrooms. Most of us who live and work in the private sector work at a very different level from that. And I felt, if you like, it was time that world had its singer too, and that's what I chose to do in Good Company.
How much of that was kind of autobiographical in that you were in the teaching world and then you made the transfer to the business world? Were any of the incidents in Good Company straight from your experience?
Well, a huge number of them were, though not necessarily from my own life. Almost all the incidents, if they didn't happen to me, that I witnessed them, if you like. I saw a great many of these things actually happening. I have to say that I've sharpened some of the conflicts into, as I said before, something more lethal. They've actually led to death, which in the actual physical death, which in my own career experience I've not seen happen. But I've seen the kinds of betrayals I describe. I've seen the kinds of strange blackmails that people get away with if they're sufficiently well-loved. I've seen people who are one day unquestionable authorities on some matter, and then when a few sales fall through or things don't turn out quite the way they wanted, they become pariahs. One day they can do no wrong, the next the company can't get rid of them quickly enough. So I would say that very few of the incidents are completely made up. Some of them I've actually lived through myself. But I believe that the overall structure, of course, is a fiction. It's not an attempt to just simply be autobiographical in the strict sense of the term.
But it's put together so seamlessly, and the one thread that runs throughout that definitely had me laughing aloud is the sense of humor. It's very wry, dry sort of humor, but it's always in there. I think that's what makes the main character so compelling, is that you've got a great sense of humor. He looks at everything in perspective, and he looks at himself with a sharp focus. So he's able to actually kind of pinpoint his own flaws. He doesn't set himself above anyone. And it really, what I just continue coming back to how fascinating it is, because although I've worked with corporations, I have to say it was definitely an eye-opening look for me at the various kind of time-wasting meetings and inability to get things done because of this and that excuse that management would come up with. Hopefully, that's not something that you come across very often.
Oh, I'm afraid I come across that. Yeah, it's my belief that the meeting is one of the great mechanisms for avoiding work. You can sit in a meeting for 8 hours and come out at the end of it feeling that you've done a good, solid day's work because you have been wrapped up in it for a full day. And the reality is that you've achieved absolutely nothing, whatever. You've done nothing productive. I often think that people go to meetings because it beats work. I have seen, I mean, this is the kind of thing I describe, I've seen many, many times meetings that end with a decision to hold another meeting. So it's not even as though a decision was actually in reality taken. What happens is that the people at the meeting decide that three other people should be involved and should be consulted in the decision that needs to be taken, and therefore the decision is to bring in those people in another meeting in 3 weeks' time. And therefore, you delay yet again. And I think, yeah, possibly one of the messages at the pure business level of Good Company is that the myth that the private sector does things much better than the public and is much more decisive and much bolder is simply a myth. There are wonderful examples of people and companies that do behave that way, that do have boldness and decisiveness on their side, but I think they're few and far between. I think most of them would prefer to delay than to decide, would prefer to discuss than to do.
I have limited, usually by the time I am called in, there has to be a solution. So seeing all the meetings upon meetings and reading the bickering and the resentment that kind of is also a thread throughout the book, how people relate to one another. It is very much a thread. But this is your, this Good Company will be your second self-published book, will it not?
Well, yes, that's true, because as you mentioned at the beginning, I have now for 5 years been publishing a regular blog, which, as you say, is called Random Views. So it's David Deason Random Views at blogspot.com. .blogspot.com. You know, 5 years, you can build up quite a lot of blog posts. In fact, when I actually downloaded the whole lot, there was something like 500,000 words there. So a good five novels worth. Not all of it, I have to admit, of absolutely top quality. A lot of it I felt could usefully be junked. So what I've come up with is something which is probably about one-fifth of that length, which contains what I think is the sort of a distillation of the best of the first 5 years on various subjects and areas. I didn't call it Random Views by mistake. I will discuss politics, as you said, what is happening today in the world, in the States or in Britain. But also I'll look at more historical subjects, or I'll look at the behavior of my cats. I have this peculiar relationship with my cats, whom I'm extremely fond of, but who insists on biting me or clawing me at a moment's notice, and I find it extremely amusing and ironic that whatever I do to win his affection just leads to my bearing more scars of his scratches. So, that kind of thing can provide material for a few blog posts as well. So, yes, that was my first venture into self-publication, was Random Views, the first 5 years.
And you've gotten, you really have garnered some great reviews for it, and I think that's because of your unapologetic way of calling it like you see it. You don't shirk. You don't try and become, what I really love the best about the political portions of Random Views, more than once my jaw dropped in a good way. I think we should always appreciate the finer quality of seeing another point of view, particularly because I'm in the States. So your view and my view of something might be completely different. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I sent my husband, who is probably right now reading David Beeson randomviews.blogspot.com, because specifically I thought you did such a bang-up job of the Middle East politics for beginners. In Random Views, you do not shirk away from the hard stuff. You absolutely get your opinion out there. It's well-reasoned. It's well thought out. And it's very illuminating. Does it take a lot of thought on your part to nail these posts?
Well, it does. It's strange. There are times when I can write something really in one sitting. I can sit down with an idea. And I often don't know where these ideas come from, I have to say. There comes the point where I think, it's been a couple of days, it's time I did another blog post, and suddenly an idea will come into my mind, and I'll write for half an hour, and I'll have something fully drafted, which I then do work on for another 20 minutes or half an hour to knock into shape, to usually cut down a bit and polish up a little. But there are times, and the one that you're referring to, I put in several hours' work on that. Very kindly, my wife Danielle drove us down here to Dorset, where we are now. And so I sat next to her in the car, and I worked and reworked the blog post I wrote this morning. So in the end, I guess it's got 3 or 4 hours of work on it.
It's worth
one
it.
Of the points,
so worth it. It's a marvelous, marvelous article, and I cannot resist. I should resist. You need to go there yourself, okay? If you're lazy and you don't want to type in David Beeson randomviews.blogspot.com, just Google Random Views David Beeson. You'll get right there. And look at this, because I have it in front of me, because before the show started, I was reading your blog, which I tried to, after reading Random Views, I tried to avoid your blog like the plague, because I wanted another compilation. but I wasn't able to stay away. But here's one of the things that makes David's blog so brilliant, and all those the 4 hours you put in, just absolutely divine results for your investment, because this is a sample line. First of all, democracy is a delicate machine, and like all machines, it needs regular oiling. So anyone with oil is a friend. I love it. I mean, I am someone who loves specific lines. And one thing that you do very well is just get lines that any writer would maybe not kill for, but maim for. Rest assured, I would probably maim to come up with that. Not you, because you need to come up with more material like this. But is it worth it at the end of the day, whenever you get the comments and have the dialogue with your readers on social media or via your blog?
Yes, I really enjoy it when people respond. Occasionally people respond angrily, and I don't mind that either. I'm happy to exchange with people who disagree with me. I don't particularly enjoy, I mean, who does, but I don't enjoy trolls very much. I don't reply to people who launch a particularly aggressive attack, but I'm more than happy to exchange with anybody. Yes, I think that's the reason I do it. Again, the reason I called it Random Views is that I know I do have a lot of random views, if you like. I'm very much a generalist. I'm not a specialist in any particular area. So I like to be able to write on what I want to write about. I was saying how an idea for a blog post may come into my mind. It could come in because, as I said, my cat has just scratched me. It could be because I listened to something on the news, you know, in the morning, and it struck me as either funny or important. And I feel that I want to be able to write something about that. And I enjoy that very much. And that's why I set up my own blog and called it Random Views, so that I could get away with saying whatever I like. But if people then react and if they comment, yes, I'm more delighted, and I'm delighted to follow it up with a discussion.
And you have an important series of blog posts coming up regarding an area of history that fascinates you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we are in the we're coming up to the 100th anniversary of the breakout of the First World War in Britain, at least in Europe. The Americans, as you know, came in a little later. And what I find absolutely fascinating is to read not so much history about that period, but the actual news of that period. And literally, I mean, going back to in the archives of the newspaper I tend to read daily, which in England, the English newspaper I read is The Guardian. In those days, it wasn't actually called The Guardian. It was called The Manchester Guardian. It was based in the city of Manchester up in the northwest of England. And they put all their archives up online, which is brilliant. And also their sister paper, The Observer, which appears on a Sunday, so you can get a newspaper every day of the week, including Sunday. So what I did is I went back to the period of the countdown to the First World War. Now, historians will all tell you, and this is what we're all taught at school, that the beginning of the run-up to the war was the murder of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria in Sarajevo on the 28th of June 1914. But what's interesting is that if you read the newspapers of the time, there is a flurry of articles about the fact that this very significant imperial personage has been murdered. But then it dies out somewhat. You know, they talk about other things. The kinds of things that were bothering people in Manchester at that time were gun running into Ireland. It looked as though the Catholics and the Protestants of Ireland were going to go to civil war. It looked that there was an uprising against the dictator in Mexico. That looked like trouble. Back in Europe, the Greeks and the Turks were massacring each other's citizens. Again, another nasty area of work. And I thought, what would it be like if one were a 20-year-old young man, perhaps a railway man living in Manchester at that time, and you and your friends at work, which probably you wouldn't get afforded by the Manchester Guardian every day of the week, But if he and his friends clubbed around to buy themselves a copy, which they would then share, what would they read in the paper? If the minister from his local chapel passed in the Observer on a Sunday, because the minister might be able to afford it, but I'm sure a railwoman wouldn't have been able to, what would he read in the Observer? And so what I'm trying to track on a day-by-day basis is the news of that time. So it's living history, if you like, yeah? What am I reading today about what happened yesterday? And I find it fascinating because really it's towards the end of July that suddenly his mind starts to get focused on the fact that this terrible catastrophe is about to happen. That what he thought was a tragedy, the killing of a senior person in Sarajevo, has turned into a major disaster for the whole of the continent in which he lives. And, of course, he himself will be caught up in it. There is almost no doubt that a young working-class man, a man of 20 in 1914, would be called up and might very well end up dead with his, all his hopes and aspirations shattered. So what I'm doing is from the 28th of July onwards, on a day-by-day basis, I'm writing a blog saying what this young man might have seen in the papers that day and how he might have reacted to them and how he thought about it and the impact on his life. So it'll be every day from the 28th of July, of June, so 28th of June through to the 4th of August, which is the day that Britain declared war on Germany. There'll be a daily blog post talking about what was happening in the life of a young railwayman in Manchester 100 years earlier to the day.
And how interesting is it that we find ourselves with conflicts again boiling around us? There's no catalyst such as the Archduke's murder, but still, I think one of the fascinating things for me as I keep track of your blog day by day, and indeed before you run this particular string, which, by the way, are you going to tell that directly from the boy's point of view?
Absolutely, yes. It's a third-person narrative, but it's very much, what he would have seen today, worrying that the Irish are still arming themselves as though it's a civil war. But also more trivial things like, he would, I'm sure, have been a keen supporter of the Lancashire County Cricket Club. So there's little comments about Lancashire did rather well yesterday or they did rather badly. It really is how he reacts to the news of the day, and that can cover a wide range of things. So very much a personal view.
And I do find it fascinating in that, again, we don't have anything setting off such a catalyst other than situations that I appreciate seeing from your point of view on the Random Views blog all the time. I like seeing, for instance, your D-Day blog. About how we in the States glorify war when it's anything other than glory-filled. I thought that was absolutely astounding, and I like the way that you put it. So really, go into your blog. Any given day, you're going to find something that's going to entertain you. Scroll down a little bit if you don't want to read about history. I do. I want to see this from the point of view of a young man who might very well be drafted during that time. I want to see that. But I also enjoy seeing, and I want to know if this is going to be a constant until the month is over. End with a flourish, and then we get to return also to your point of view about what's happening today, which I appreciate very much, because you bring up issues that I might not have access to here in the States, and even better yet, sometimes you dissect with an unerring eye and incredible wit exactly what is happening here in the States. How do you manage to kind of immerse yourself so well in political events in so many different countries?
Well, I have to say that I have been fascinated by the States for a very long time. I am interested in history, and really the first area of history that I got most deeply involved in was American history, perhaps because I'm quite lazy and there isn't a huge amount of it. Joking aside, I think that it is a particularly interesting area of human experience and endeavor, which I think matters to all of us outside the United States almost as much as to people inside the United States. It was the first democracy. It was the first place that actually made, the 10 sets of rights summed up in the first 10 amendments, basic legal requirements on a society. These are rights that I think we now enjoy in Britain as well, but it took the Americans to say, hang on, we're actually going to codify these and require them by statute. So I think there's a huge amount about this United States that should interest any of us anywhere. But also the other thing that I've begun to feel as the years go by is that far less separates us than perhaps I first thought. Many of our attitudes are very similar. We are very much cousins, even if we're not perhaps brothers. So I feel very close to Americans, if you like, and therefore to America. There are, of course,
as well, you should, because I've been doing genealogical research as well, and you would be amazed at how many of us are probably, in reality, your cousins.
No, well, quite, yes, I'm sure that's absolutely right, yes. As it happens, I do actually have physical cousins in Belgium who speak French as their mother tongue, and that means that they are slightly foreign to me. But Americans, who may be more distant cousins from me, do speak the same language as me. And the linguistic community is a very important community, I think. I think, it means that even if we don't agree, we think in the same terms, in the very literal sense. We use the same words to express our thoughts. So that creates a bond, which in many ways makes me closer to you as a cousin, Lydia, than perhaps some of the people who are my uncle's children, if you like, because they are in some other sense foreigners. So I do feel very close to the Americans. There are, however, huge differences in attitude on certain things. I do have difficulty, but then I think quite a few Americans have difficulty with this as well, with the U.S. approach to gun control. It does seem to me that in Britain, a man gets angry with another man, reaches for a weapon, and what he finds is maybe a glass if he's in a bar. Maybe he can even break a chair in a bar and use a chair leg. The result of that violence, which he will then engage in, the violence will be just as unpleasant in Britain as it would be in the States, but the results are likely to be one man injured, maybe one man dead, but not 30 men dead. Because he doesn't have a gun to hand. So that's one of the things that I do keep coming back to. I find the differences across the Atlantic over gun control interesting and fascinating and worth exploring. I also find the attitude towards war, and this is what you were mentioning before, interesting and worth studying, because there is, as I said in that particular blog about D-Day, this desire to glorify the soldier while he's vertical, while he's in uniform, while he's fit and healthy and going into action on behalf of the country. But the soldier who is back home, maybe on crutches, maybe in a wheelchair, maybe unable to re-assimilate into society, who is perhaps living rough, who has become a drug addict perhaps, who can't cope with his PTSD in any other way. We tend, and this is not just America, but it happens in Britain very much too, we tend to turn our backs on those people. And yet they're the same people. And I feel that we have a debt to those people. And what I suppose what I criticize a little in America, but I criticize it in Britain as well, it doesn't happen maybe to the same extent here as in the States, is this glorification of the man while he's fit, and indifference to him when he's broken.
That's prevalent here. I mean, it's first of all, we need to put things in context. I now live in Texas. So the points that you have put out, it's a deeply conservative state. And what alarms me is that gun control is a very real issue. Whenever there have been 74, I think they've just reported there were 74 school shootings. Something needs to be done about it. And yet that, like the veterans of whom you speak, are literally just cast to the side. And for what? The right to bear arms, and the right to protect your company, your country for the sake of freedom. You did an excellent blog on that that said, well, what freedom? And you quoted a veteran who said, okay, I can see where this war was necessary for freedom, but the war since, not so much. And I thought that was a compelling and wonderful piece you did on that.
Well, absolutely. I'm glad you think that. I appreciate that very much. Today's blog post, if you like, picks up that very point. You know, we sent young people into Iraq as well. A lot of them were killed or hurt. A lot of them were damaged. There have been many articles about many of the Iraqi veterans back in the States with terrible, in many cases, terrible brain injuries, simply being inside an armored vehicle when a roadside bomb goes off, an IED goes off, can lead to terrible damage just by reverberation inside the vehicle. So even though you come out apparently unhurt, the damage to your brain is very significant. These guys have come back. Many of them are in jail or they're on drugs or suffering terrible mental difficulties. And I have to say, for what? I think that's what that veteran that I quoted was saying. You went onto the beaches at Omaha and Utah in Normandy. You were fighting for something which I think even now most of us would agree was worth it. More than worth it. It had to be done. Somehow we had to stop Hitler. But going into Iraq, we overthrew Saddam Hussein, and that's a great thing. But what's happening there now? What have we replaced him by? And how many American or British lives, or indeed Iraqi lives, was it worth sacrificing for the little we've achieved?
Right, and you know, the question that I want to ask, because we may or may not have a commercial break, and the reason for that is I can't get enough of talking with David. That's just the way it is. But the interesting thing to me, and this is my perception in the States, and I'm not sugarcoating it for you, this is how I really feel, I would like to know your perception, because it seems to me that the United States, my country, gets involved. They have their fingers in a little too much at all times. So my perception is, as allies with Britain, we drag you along into conflicts perhaps you don't want to be involved in. But I don't know if that's an actual sentiment held by you or not. Am I way off course here?
No, I think you're absolutely right, except that, if you like, I think we follow in the wake of the United States much too willingly. There is an inclination, certainly in our political class, to ape the United States in the completely misguided hope that the United States will regard Britain as somehow an equal, which it certainly isn't. In military power, we're trivial in comparison to the United States. But I think Tony Blair, for instance, was very, very keen on his relationship with George W. Bush as a means of enhancing the prestige of Britain on the world stage. And that meant going into Iraq. And it's absolutely clear that a very significant majority of the British population was against that happening. We had the biggest protest marches that have ever been seen in this country to oppose that war. But we went in anyway, because Tony Blair had made up his mind that we were going to come what may. Now, had it been something that had achieved some huge breakthrough or some huge defense and freedom, I might now have to say, well, he was right and I was wrong. When we look at what's happening in Iraq today, I have to say it might have been better just to let life and death take its course. How much longer would Saddam Hussein have lived anyway? Would his sons have been allowed to take power after him. As a general rule, one of those dictators dies. Those regimes aren't that stable. They look it, but they're not. Had he died, might there not have been a transition to some better form? I'm not saying a Western democracy, but some better form of government after him than there had been while he was alive, without the costs of that war. And I'm not talking financial costs. I'm talking about the cost in terms of Iraqi casualties, but also American casualties and British casualties for what we now have. And again, you quoted my blog post of today earlier on, and there's another quote from it, which actually I borrowed from somebody else, which is saying that under Saddam Hussein, people lived in fear of that terrible dictator, and today they live in fear of terrible terrorism. What is not changed is the fear in which the Iraqi population lives.
And fear is the tool. Fear is what, yes. And this is just my opinion, but fear is what a lot of governments, this is my perception, and in my perception, I'm a human being, it could be faulty, but I can say from my country, fear is the tool to make the sale. And the interesting bit going on here at present is that you're not going to make that sale with the American people. And what I find interesting is it juxtaposes what happened when we went in with Iraq the last time, where the British people were protesting and saying, no, we don't want to do this. Yeah. The American people seem to be saying that right now. And yet, at what point do we need to get it across? How much louder do the British people or the American people or anyone else whose government says this is what we will do and we do not care what you have to say? At what point does that change? I suppose that's the lesson from history that I will never get my head around, because we know what happens, do we not? We know what happens whenever there's a wide gap between the wealthy and the less fortunate, the poverty-stricken. We've seen that repeat itself time after time in human history, and I wonder, at what point is our technological or our intellect or our common sense going to say, well, just because that's the way it's always been, doesn't mean we need to continue that particular lesson that history's trying to tell us not to repeat?
Yeah, it's a fascinating,
See, you lead me astray.
It's hard to know how long people...
I think I can hear you. David's on Skype, so there's a little bit of a lag, and add to that, you're coming in a bit faint, David. Are you still there?
I'm still here, yes. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, good, excellent. Well, yeah, I think your point is absolutely right, that there has to come a time when people start to say no to this kind of thing. I think it may have happened. There was a very last autumn when there was a move to in fact, funny enough, that was a point where Britain perhaps did exert more influence. And in those same terms, the leader of Ed Miliband of the Labour Party, motion in Parliament applying the missiles into Syria. I think his aim was to get a different motion, not to drop the proposal altogether, but to get it changed. But he had to, just for procedural reasons, he had to start by opposing the government motion. And to his astonishment, I believe his astonishment, he won the vote. And the government said, well, there can be no further vote. That's it. We're not doing it. And I think that wasn't what he intended. But we got a wonderful and most unusually encouraging case of the effect of unintended consequences. As a result of that vote in the British Parliament, Britain officially decided not to back a missile strike on Syria. And I believe that had a very considerable impact in your own House of Representatives, and indeed Senate, actually, I seem to remember the debate in both houses changed. And as a result, the United States did not launch its missile strike on Syria without Britain's support. So I think there what we got was, at last, a pushback. Because, if you like, what I think the big problem is with the way Britain and the United States have behaved in recent decades, actually, is that they've come to believe that there are very few political problems internationally that cannot be solved militarily. And they're totally wrong, because these military solutions aren't really solutions at all. And I think in this particular instance, finally, a lesson was learned. Government was told, don't do this, and they didn't. And you know, I think it would have been a disaster to do it, because the people on whose behalf we were acting was a rebel front, which includes ISIS, the very people who Obama is now talking about bombing in Iraq. So we would have been bombing the regime in Syria in support, people that we now intend to bomb in Iraq. And there is an incoherence and a failure to see through what you're doing in this kind of thinking that finally needs to be exposed and stopped. And maybe over the Syrian missile crisis, it finally happened. And I just hope that we keep pushing in that way, and we keep saying, use the military when you have to, but don't make it your weapon of first resort. It really must be a weapon of last resort. But one of the reasons why I'm so interested in the First World War, Britain has not been at peace in any single complete year since 1914. It seems extraordinary. For 100 years, Britain has never known a year where we haven't been involved in war somewhere in the world. 2015, next year, looks like being the very first year since the outbreak of the First World War, when Britain will not have been at war anywhere. If we don't get involved in any other kind of military adventure in the next 12 months, we may actually know our first year of peace in a century. I find that an appalling state of affairs.
It is appalling, but you have to set that precedent. That's what I hope Britain does. I hope that precedent is set, because once the people know peace, they will continue to clamor to continue that peace instead of blindly agreeing to get into more conflict.
I agree. That's what I'm hoping, that people will take that attitude. I'm not saying that military interventions are always a failure. I think we were right to go into Kosovo and prevent ethnic cleansing there. We were wrong not to go into Rwanda and prevent the massacres there, the genocide there. There are times when the military can do a job and perhaps are the only way of doing the job. And that's the point at which you have to say, yes, take military action. Go in and prevent some awful catastrophe like Rwanda. But I think you should not kid yourself. You shouldn't think that just dropping some missiles on somebody is going to lead to the emergence of a democratic state or some kind of wonderful ideal society with which we can feel completely at ease. It doesn't happen that way. I often say that the military is a bit like the fire brigade. When your house is on fire, you really, really want the firemen there. Get the fire out. Once the fire is out, you want them gone. The last thing you want is men with big boots and axes and hoses tramping around your house. You want them out of the way, so you can get on with cleaning up and redecorating and replacing furniture and so forth. You do not want the firemen there. And I think the same is true of the military. If a bunch of terrible militiamen about to come in and rape your women and destroy your houses and kill your kids, yes, then what could be better than U.S. Marines? The best trained force in the world. We'd love them to come in and rescue you. But once
that's part of the problem.
They should leave. They should leave then.
I think the problems that we're seeing and you pointed it out very adroitly, which is there's a perspective I'm not sure that the international community is looking at, and perhaps they should be, which is look at the proliferation of arms in our country, of weapons, of people that we kill with our old hands, and look at, you know, how huge our military is. Now, it's not, I think, a lapse of judgment or a leap beyond logic to say, well, of course the United States goes to armed combat, military, drones, bombs, because look at what their people do. And perhaps this is not the best path we want to follow. So, in fact, we may come to find, I hope that we come to find, in the years to come that adjusting, modifying our gun laws now to protect the people has the larger effect of us thinking twice that military conflict is going to solve all problems. I think that's part of the problem we have right now in our country, is that we, the people, think that having a gun means that you can resolve any conflicts, when in fact, generally, it means you wind up dead and take a lot of innocent people with you. That seems to me to be the micro view, whereas the macro is what the U.S. Marines and our other armed forces have been inflicting on other countries, some of whom have not asked for our interference.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Violence should be the last resort and not the first. And, you know, I mean, that's a piece of wisdom I think we've learned from the States, funnily enough. I mean, at the end of the First World War, coming back to that, Britain and France insisted on reparations from Germany and I think prepared the outbreak of the Second World War by taking that attitude. At the end of the Second World War, the United States insisted on doing exactly the reverse. Instead of demanding that Germany paid, we had Marshall Aid pouring into Germany to rebuild the nation. And I believe that an awful lot of issues could be resolved around the world by the United States spending one-tenth of what it spends on conflict, investing in countries, and making them, turning them into friends instead of going to war with them and impoverishing both itself and them by doing so.
And that's a perfect view, because that's the solution here. And until we find that that's not a solution at all, you know, I look at the United States and I see us as an adolescent country, and we act out like adolescents. We need a bit more time to grow and realize that whenever someone says something to your girlfriend, as a probably bad analogy, you don't whip out a gun and shoot him. You find a way to get along and compromise, listen to your girlfriend, it's not that bad, you know. Anything other than the incessant violence inside and outside our country. And no one would be happier to see our defense spending go down. We need to kind of take care of our own as well. But that said,
yes.
See, it's very difficult for me to talk to you without getting into history. You are such a fan of history. You write so eloquently about it. And politics is one of the great joys I have of your prose, perfect as it is. And I know you won't agree, but I don't care. It's my point of view. I'm entitled to it. I am excited for everything you come out with. I am fortunate enough to have been able to read Random Views and Good Company. And I think the way you have with words is extraordinary. And I, for one, would be quite fine with a blog compilation or any compilation about your cat.
Well, I must admit, I do enjoy my stories about my cat. And I enjoy the time I spend with my cat, even when he's attacking me viciously. There are times, you see, when I regard mindless violence as quite amusing. And I must say, although this conversation that you and I are having has been somewhat earnest and serious, I do think that one of the ways of dealing with this kind of conundrum and, you know, the contradictions that we face is to laugh at them. So one thing I do feel very, very strongly is that to be a little humorous about these things matters too. To see the the inconsistencies and the ridiculous nature of some of the things that we do, and not be completely depressed by them. So again, that's one of the reasons why I write Random News. It's to see if we can smile at some of the things that are going on around the world, because the smile is the gesture or the behavior most deeply associated with the very men of reason, the men of the Enlightenment, that produced Jefferson and others. The smile is the smile of reason. And so if we can smile a little, maybe we can find our way to reason.
Well, if anyone can make us smile, that would be you.
Well, I try to, and certainly my cat helps.
Well, you succeed, and you must remember, of course, that as you mentioned in one of your blog posts, you are, of course, your cat's servant, no more and no less.
I think anybody who has a cat and who hasn't understood that he's a domestic and nothing else, has understood nothing about having a cat. The notion that you are somehow the cat's master and owner is a complete illusion. And it only takes a fairly sensible and self-willed cat like mine to make it very clear that it is an illusion.
Well, it's also the thoughts that you put in his head that are so amusing, and that's something you can also find in Random Views, the compilation. You can find a great many of David's cat's adventures, and they are quite rewarding in a laughable sense.
Yes, I do find quite a lot of these things laughable, and I hope I find myself laughable as well, because I think... if laughter is and the smile is very much at the start of reason, I think an ability to laugh at yourself is key to learning to laugh.
Deprecation honed into a fine blade, and you do not avoid cutting yourself with it. Of course, you know my view on self-deprecation. I think it's an art form, and it is one I intend to be called an artist at. But you make it to where you are clearly laughing at yourself, and yet you're also laughing with us who are looking at your misfortune to have to get up at 5 a.m., and take a swim because you want to remain healthy.
Yes, I think that's one of the most appalling aspects of modern life, isn't it? You know, that we live these sedentary existences, and therefore we have to impose an appalling regime of torture on ourselves to try to maintain health. I can think of very few things less natural than to get into cold water at 6:30 in the morning on a winter's day. I rather hoped that getting into the cold water on a summer's day would be marginally less painful, but now that we're in the summer, I can tell you it really is very marginal. There is no delight about getting into a swimming pool at some ghastly hour of the morning, but it's necessary. Life requires that. So there's irony aplenty just in that.
Well, there's perspective as well, because as I mentioned earlier, I live in Texas, and so around July, the pool water, the lake water, any water that's been left out in any great quantity is roughly the equivalent of warm bath water. There is no relief to be found in it. So paradoxically, I have the exact opposite situation
that
you do, because you will not find people outside in summer. I tell everyone that Texas is where the asphalt weeps and fried eggs dot the sidewalks, and that does happen.
Yes, I can imagine. Yes. We think it's becoming unbearably hot when the temperature reaches what we call 20, which I guess about 67, 70 degrees. We begin to melt at that stage, so you can see it's a very different existence.
Yes, because we regularly get to 30 Celsius. So it's interesting, and that's why Random Views is something you should already have bought by the beginning of this. We can find Random Views where, by the way, David?
It's on Amazon. If you look for me, so David Beeson, BWSON, Random Views. It's available on Amazon for download to Kindle at whatever the minimum price is these days on Amazon. I think it's 99 cents or something.
And then, now, Good Company, though, are there going to be any, because you're going into these, the point of view of this boy during the war, during the beginning of events stirring him into seeing there might be something unpleasant coming, are you going to have any announcements on your blog regarding Good Company coming out?
Yes, I most certainly shall. I'll be announcing it in the next few weeks as soon as I have a final date. As I said at the beginning, I'm really only waiting for a cover to be available. I think that's what we said that before we started. As soon as I receive the cover, it'll be going up, and I'll certainly be announcing it a week or two in advance and then regularly thereafter to make sure that the greatest possible number of people take advantage of it.
Oh yes, it's absolutely marvelous. Let me put it this way: I am no snob. Therefore, while I have had the superb opportunity to read Good Company and enjoyed it immensely, I'm going to buy it anyway because it's worth reading again. I've already bought Random Views. And there's another little book, which, of course, I've waited till the very last moments, and that's End of the Road, which is another book I'm hoping. Do you have any kind of – will that be something we could look forward to next year, or do you have a date in mind?
Spring of next year is what I was thinking of. Yeah, End of the Road is, again, based on experiences in business and follows the career of a man who has to meet and cope with increasing numbers of difficulties in both his professional life and his domestic life, seen through the eyes of a close friend. And again, an awful lot of the incidents are drawn from my own life or lives of people that I know. So what I have observed, if it isn't what I've experienced.
But it is a whole different book because I've had the opportunity to read that as well, and I will be buying that when it comes out next spring as well because when you look at Good Company and then End of the Road, they're two totally different universes. So when David says, oh, yes, business is involved again, do not make the mistake of thinking they're anything alike. They absolutely are not. He's created so many gems of characters, Alex, and, of course, Craig. There's so many. It's just an outstanding book. I'm already thinking ahead to how do I review these things because they are so good. There are so many things that happen in Good Company and in End of the Road. It's very difficult to know how to summarize all the good bits that you have in both books.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much. And I have to say, thank you for having me because your input has been invaluable. In greatly improving what I think I started with.
You have your mark in order. Send me any more because I'm more than happy to read. I might very well read a shopping list of yours.
You're very kind.
Well, if you wrote it, like you write your blog or Random Views or Good Company or End of the Road, yes, I think I wouldn't actually even pay you for that that list if it were written in your style.
That sounds like a challenge, Lydia. I'll have to see if I can come up with a shopping list worth reading.
I think you can do it, and I will be looking for that. But time is literally slipping away from us. David, I just cannot thank you enough for appearing on the show. It is always a treat to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you again, Lydia. Tremendous. A lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, everybody, really quick, because time really is getting away from me, it always does when I talk to David Beeson. Google him, David Beeson, Random Views, read his blog, buy Good Company when it comes out in the next couple weeks. And speaking of the next couple weeks, I will be having Kat Damon, author of Taming Darkness, on the show in 2 weeks' time. Absolutely fabulous read. Every father out there, have a great Father's Day, and everyone else, have a fabulous weekend. Thanks so much for talking, well, for listening to us here on Lydia's Literary Lowdown right here on WGGM.